will ever be able to share. Maybe I did describe it. Keith Kreitman, World War II veteran, as told to Colonel Grossman. Like Keith Kreitman, most of the individuals who have been in combat will tell you that it is simply indescribable. There are no words to depict it. It is like trying to describe a vivid painting without having words for colors and hues. Now, with the research outlined in this section, we have begun to collect descriptive terms to create a rough palette of basic primary colors to paint a crude picture that will help us understand each individual's diverse experience in the realm of combat. In painting our picture, we must never forget that combat is 99% sheer boredom and 1% pure terror. But it is within the realm of 1% pure terror that we have the most to learn. It is where pioneers like Dr. Artwall and Dr. Klinger, whose research is outlined in this section, have blazed a trail for others to follow. Chapter 1, The Eyes and the Ears, Auditory Exclusion, Intensified Sound, and Tunnel Vision. Who is so deaf or so blind, as is he, that willfully will neither hear nor see? John Heywood, circa 1565, Proverbs. A bizarre set of perceptual distortions can occur in combat that alter the way the warrior views the world and perceives reality. It truly can be an altered state of consciousness, similar to what occurs in a drug-induced state or when sleeping. It is amazing that we never knew about this before. All we had to do was ask. Now that we are asking combat veterans the right questions, we have learned more in the last few decades than the previous 5,000 years, and we are learning more every day. Police psychologist Dr. Alexis Artwall has conducted what I believe to be some of the best research on perceptual distortions in combat. Dr. Artwall and Lauren Christensen collected this data in their book, Deadly Force Encounters, which I highly recommend to my military and law enforcement audiences. Note that the perceptual distortions of hearing and vision that are addressed in this chapter are significantly different from normal day-to-day experiences in which you don't notice certain sights and sounds simply because you are not paying attention to them. Not seeing or hearing something because you are concentrated on something else is a psychological manifestation, whereas tunnel vision and auditory exclusion appear to involve both psychological concentration influences and powerful physiological effects caused by biomechanical changes to the eye and ear. We need much more research on this topic, but the dominant theory at this time is that these biomechanical changes to the sensory organs are a side effect of vasoconstriction and the other stress responses that were addressed earlier. Auditory exclusion. Our guns just went pop. In rage, deaf as the sea, hasty as fire. Shakespeare, King Richard II. Dr. Artwall surveyed 141 police officers who had been in what law enforcement agencies sometimes call deadly force encounters. We would call them gunfights. She found that more than 8 out of 10 officers experienced diminished sound. That is, the gunshots got quiet. Hunters know that they will be temporarily deafened, and their ears will ring for the rest of the day if they do not wear hearing protection when they zero in their deer rifles. Yet they do not wear hearing protection when they actually shoot a deer, and they often do not hear the shots, or the sound is muted, and their ears do not ring afterwards. If this is a common stress response to shooting a deer, how much greater would that stress response be if the deer were shooting back? Consider this classic example of auditory exclusion from deadly force encounters. My partner and I were pursuing a stolen vehicle, The suspect was driving erratically, stopping only when the vehicle spun out of control and crashed into a ditch. My partner had the shotgun and I had my semi-auto drawn as we cautiously approached. When a bullet exploded out one of the windows, I opened fire. I faintly heard one round go off, then nothing. I could feel the recoil of my own gun, so I knew I was firing, but I didn't hear the shotgun, and I was afraid my partner had been shot. When it was all over, it turns out I had fired 9 rounds, and my partner, who was 5 feet away, had fired 4 shotgun rounds. The suspect also got off 2 more rounds before we killed him. Neither of us was injured. I had no idea how many rounds we had fired until I was told later. To this day, I still have no memory of hearing any gunfire except that first round. The vast majority of officers reporting diminished sound upon firing indicated that it was their gunshots that were muted, or at the most, their shot sounded like a cap gun or pop gun. Others said that their shots were not as loud as they should have been, while a small number said they did not hear them at all. One SWAT sniper reported that he and another team member fired their weapons simultaneously in a small room, yet the twin gunshots, even in a confined space, sounded quiet. Masoud Ayoub is a national champion competitive shooter, a law enforcement trainer, a leading researcher, and one of the most prolific police writers today. He put it this way during our personal correspondence on this subject. Everything I've seen tells me that most of auditory exclusion, like most of tunnel vision, is a matter of cortical perception. The ears still hear, and the eyes still see, but as it focuses on the survival mission, the cortex of the brain is screening out awareness of what it deems insignificant to the goal. This process of tuning out sensory input happens all the time. As you listen to this, you are probably not conscious of the feel of your shoes or the waistband of your pants. You are also probably tuning out all kinds of background noises, such as the hum of your refrigerator or distant traffic. Our brains must constantly tune out sensory data or we would be overwhelmed. In extreme stress situations, this screening process can be even more intense, as we tune out all senses except the one we need for survival. Usually, that one sense is vision. But in low-light conditions, the ears can turn on and the eyes turn off, as the combatants hear the gunshot, but tune out the less salient muzzle flashes. Masoud Ayoub is quite correct. There is definitely a mental cognitive component to this. The brain is screening out awareness of what it deems insignificant to the goal, and the goal is survival. But if your ears don't ring after shots are fired, that would indicate that there might also be a physical shutdown of some kind in the inner ear. Reports from the audiology research community indicate that the ear can physically, mechanically, shut out loud sounds, just as the eyelid can shut out bright lights. It would appear that this biomechanical shutdown of the ear can occur in a millisecond in response to sudden loud noises. 2 things are happening here. First, there is a form of oral or auditory tunnel vision in which specific sounds, such as sirens, are tuned out under high stress. We tune out unnecessary sounds and focus on one sound all the time. When I was a young private sleeping in the barracks, I learned how to tune out the grating snores coming from a fellow soldier by listening intently to the steady droning sounds of air whistling out of a heating vent. Something very similar, but much more intense, is happening in combat as we mentally shut down unneeded sensory stimuli and focus on the one thing that is critically needed. Then there is a form of oral or auditory blink in which loud noises are physically and mechanically muted or silenced for a brief moment. There is not even the usual ringing of the ears afterward. This auditory blink can be roughly broken down into 3 types. One response, which appears to happen at lower levels of arousal, perhaps in condition yellow, is to soften or shut down the sounds of your own shots, which at some level you are anticipating, while the sounds of someone shooting next to you can be deafening. This happens often when two hunters fire together at a game animal, and I know of several cases where an officer has reported that his own shot sounded quiet, while the shots fired by another officer standing next to him were deafening. All such cases that I know of involve moderate levels of stress. Another response, which seems to occur under extreme stress situations, perhaps in condition black, is to shut out all sounds so that you do not remember hearing anything afterwards. Apparently, the greater the stress, the more powerful this effect. This is not an oral blink, but rather the auditory equivalent of squeezing your eyes shut until the bad man goes away. This appears to be associated with exceptional stress, extreme heart rates, and intense physiological arousal. A third response, which is probably the most common, occurs when you shut out all gunshots, but you hear everything else, including the shouts of those around you and the tinkle of your expended brass hitting the floor. This appears to be a classic condition red response, in which your body is capable of biomechanically shutting down your ear in a millisecond in response to the leading edge of the shock wave of a gunshot, and then reopening immediately so you hear everything else around you. In Dr. Dave Klinger's superb book, Voices from the Kill Zone, he tells of a SWAT officer who fired a burst from a fully automatic submachine gun, reported that while he did not hear his shots, he did hear the clack-clack sound of the weapon cycling as the slide moved forward and backward, ejecting spent casings and delivering fresh rounds to the breech. It is simply astounding that the body is apparently capable of this, and even more astounding that we never knew about it until recently. I was teaching on this subject in one Midwestern state, and a state trooper said, "Now I understand what happened. It was so embarrassing. I never told anyone about it. My partner and I were on a one-car roadblock. A guy blows the roadblock at 100 miles an hour. We both fire one shot as we leap out of the way. I called the sarge and said, 'Sarge, he's blown the roadblock.' And the sarge tells us to pursue him. I said, 'Sarge, we can't pursue. Honest, our guns just went pop.' We thought there was something wrong with our ammo. We actually took a pencil and ran it down the barrel of our weapons because we were afraid there might be a bullet lodged there." How many warriors across the generations have fired their weapons and failed to continue fighting because they thought there was something wrong with their weapons when they could not hear the shots? In this case, there was nothing wrong with their ammunition or their weapons, but there was definitely something wrong with their training. We have gone through centuries of the gunpowder era, and we are just now informing our warriors that their shots might get quiet in combat. As I collect data from literally thousands of warriors about their combat experiences, this auditory exclusion effect is the single most common occurrence. Consider this example of a police sniper taking a shot at an armed assailant. The rifle fires, but I don't hear it. That's not quite true. I hear it, but it sounds very far away. There is no recoil. The sight picture is not lost. I see the small white hole form in the glass, and behind it I see her head explode. The sight picture has turned murky. Something doesn't look right. It's then that I realize the reason my sight picture is murky is that her skull and brain have been blown all over the inside of the car and are now dripping down from the headliner and sliding down the windows. Russ Gligin, After the Echo. There is reason to believe that the biomechanical aspects of this auditory exclusion effect can occur in a millisecond, given only the briefest intuition of warning. Author Gavin De Becker tells of an unintentional discharge of his weapon that occurred early in his career of managing protective assignments. At the end of a work shift, he pointed his semi-automatic pistol in a safe direction and began easing the hammer down so as to clear it. But something happened and the weapon accidentally discharged. No one was hit, but the noise of the pistol firing in that small room was so painfully loud that all the individuals who were present complained afterwards of their ears ringing, except Gavin. Gavin De Becker is the world's leading expert in the realm of intuition and danger, and author of the best-selling book, The Gift of Fear, which is a true classic on the topic. Discussing this incident with me years later, he realized that, at some intuitive level, he must have had a brief millisecond of warning that the hammer was not going down properly, and that was all his body needed to shut down the sound. It is not just gunshots that can go unheard. Many police officers tell me that they did not hear their vehicle sirens or the sirens of other emergency vehicles during their deadly force encounters. One California park officer told me how he tuned out the sound of a helicopter hovering overhead during his gunfight. This is probably happening in the brain rather than as a mechanical mechanism in the ear, and is the equivalent of oral tunnel vision as opposed to an oral blink. Warriors often do not hear the shouted communications that occur in combat. Small unit leaders have always understood that in order to get the attention of their troops and be heard and seen in combat, they have to be in front of them. Infantry fire team leaders do not get in front of their men in the most dangerous position on the battlefield because they want to. They do it because they have to, if they are going to be seen and their commands are going to be heard. Even then, you cannot be certain that a command will be heard in combat. This narrative from a police training officer is an example of a very common occurrence. Many times I have seen students with auditory exclusion in some of our training scenarios. We have a person enter a scenario playing an armed off-duty officer or an armed citizen and announce their presence. But the good guys only see the gun, and many times the person gets shot, so to speak. It is for this reason that we recommend that whether you mean well or not, you need to announce your presence from behind cover and expose minimally when arriving on a scene that is already hot. There have been some recent real-life shootings that emphasize the need for this. If this is happening in the limited stress of training scenarios, you can bet that it is also happening in combat. The second type of auditory exclusion. You don't hear the one that gets you. An old adage, which apparently dates back to World War I and refers to incoming artillery, states, you don't hear the one that gets you. In my interviews with numerous combat veterans since the publication of the first edition of On Combat, I have confirmed that this appears to be literally true in most cases. Consider these incidents. A Canadian accidentally bombed by the U.S. Air Force in Afghanistan. A Navy SEAL hit by a rocket-propelled grenade. A U.S. Army officer hit by multiple improvised explosive devices, IEDs, during several tours in Iraq. A U.S. Army Special Forces officer under enemy mortar fire in Operation Anaconda in Afghanistan. A booby-trapped police car explodes in the officer's face when he opens the driver's side door. All of these individuals told me the same thing. When an explosion is close enough to slam your body with a powerful concussion, you do not hear the sound, and your ears do not ring afterward. For example, the police officer with a booby-trapped car says that although the bomb blew him off his feet, he was able to call the dispatcher on his cell phone and speak without ringing in his ears or problems communicating. Explosions further away can be extremely loud and cause ear ringing and loss of hearing, but it would appear that many people do not hear the ones that are close enough to create a powerful physical impact on your body. Thus, it would seem that the old veterans were telling us the truth when they said, you don't hear the one that gets you. This is apparently a form of auditory exclusion, similar to what we have already discussed, which many people experience when shooting a rifle in combat or while hunting. In these cases, which I term type 1 auditory exclusion, the individuals firing the weapons report that they did not hear the sound or that the sound was muffled and that their ears did not ring afterward. The auditory system appears to blink, creating a biomechanical shutdown that protects the ears from ringing afterwards. However, as we have observed so far in this audiobook, type 1 auditory exclusion, for example, does not happen when you are under the stress of competitive shooting. It only happens in the actual killing circumstances of recreational hunting and combat. Type 2 auditory exclusion can happen when you are completely relaxed, i.e., not in an excited state, and appears to be a result of the body receiving two simultaneous and overwhelming sensory stimuli. In a conversation with Gavin De Becker, author of The Gift of Fear, he pointed out that when a creature in nature lands on your back and roars at the same time, your dominant survival information would be the sensation of something on your back. Under stress, the body tends to tune out all senses but one to avoid sensory overload and confusion. In this case, it is the impact of the creature that the human body interprets as vital survival data. Tom Davis, a retired U.S. Army colonel and a Vietnam veteran, gave me a classic example of this phenomenon. I was wounded in Vietnam by an RPG, a rocket-propelled grenade. It hit no more than 3 to 5 yards from me. I saw the fireball but did not feel the concussion, nor did I hear the sound. My ears had closed automatically. My ears became functional again immediately. I lay under the front of a Jeep, and I thought another RPG was coming. However, I was hearing the air coming out of all four tires. The concussion should have burst my eardrums, but did not. We should thank God for building these automatic shutdowns in our body. Later in the year, the compound I was in came under attack. The incoming bombardment was so loud that my captain was screaming in the radio that we were under attack. I was screaming at him to get back under cover. I could not hear myself screaming, and he could not hear himself for the sounds of the incoming. In the second incident, Colonel Davis believed that his ears were working, that auditory exclusion wasn't happening, because the incoming rounds were outside the bunker, and he was somewhat protected from the concussion. This phenomenon might also explain why some individuals who have accidentally shot themselves often report that they did not hear the shot and their ears did not ring afterward. Again, in this situation, the body experiences two simultaneous and overwhelming stimuli, the sound of the gun and the feel of the bullet hitting. Although there might not be pain initially, we can hypothesize that the body is immediately aware of physical trauma and the sound has been tuned out. Thus, we now begin to understand that when the old veterans told us, "You don't hear the one that gets you," they were telling us the truth. And this old saying now joins the ranks of these other adages: scared out of your wits, shut down of forebrain processing, so scared you can't see straight, loss of near vision, loss of depth perception, and loss of peripheral vision, and scared shitless, loss of bowel and bladder control, as being accurate representations of what is actually happening in combat. Intensified sounds. You hunker down and die, blind and afraid. Sight was gone, and fears possessed me. Francis Rowley, I Will Sing the Wondrous Story. In Dr. Artwall's research, 85% of the individuals she interviewed experienced diminished sound. But for 16%, the sound of gunshots was intensified. Under what circumstance would the brain choose to shut down the eyes and turn on the ears in low light conditions? This is because, again, the brain focuses on the salient stimulus. And in the dark, the salient stimulus is sound. modern police and military trained to fire at man-shaped silhouettes and photorealistic images of humans. While this is fine, the problem is that in the dark, it is difficult, if not impossible, to see the threat. Often the muzzle flash is the only visual stimulus in a gunfight under low-light conditions. The eyes turn off, the ears turn on, and, as one law enforcement trainer put it, you hunker down and die, blind and afraid. John Peterson, an Army Green Beret and innovative firearms instructor, conducted extensive research on this matter while serving as a trainer at the SIG Arms Academy in New Hampshire. John and his people would take a trainee into a dark room for a foursome force gunpowder projectile paint bullet exercise, where they would fire one or two rounds into the trainee's bulletproof vest the moment he stepped into the room. In almost every instance, the trainee returned fire at the sound. Only a bat can precisely triangulate the location of an attacker based on sound. To accurately zero in on an attacker in low-light conditions, it is best to aim at the muzzle flash. To teach this, Peterson brought his students into a darkened room and fired multiple rounds of paint bullet ammunition to show what the flash looked like. Gunpowder-propelled paint bullet ammunition emits a muzzle flash, making it particularly effective for this kind of training. Once the students were mentally cocked and primed to look for this stimulus, the next time they walked into the darkened room and were shot with a paint bullet, they zeroed in on the muzzle flash with accurate shots. From that point on, they performed in night combat situations with a much higher degree of proficiency. Sometimes a warrior transitions back and forth from the visual to the auditory and back again, depending on which sense he needs the most at the moment. This explains Dr. Artwall's findings that 85% of officers in gunfights experienced auditory exclusion and 16% diminished sound, which adds up to 101%. Since some individuals experienced both in the same gunfight. One officer told me that on one occasion he was at the bottom of a stairwell, with a suspect above him shooting down at him. He said the sound of the gunshots was overwhelming. "I had a shotgun in my hand," he said. "I raised it, drew a bead on this guy, and all of a sudden the shots got quiet." When the officer got a visual lock on with the suspect, his eyes turned on, and his ears turned off, a phenomenon that happens frequently when warriors are caught in an ambush. The sounds of the incoming shots are initially overwhelming. Boom, boom, boom. Since he's taken by surprise, he has limited visual ability. But after he quickly scans the environment and gets a visual lock on the attacker, the shots become quiet. Sometimes there is an opposite effect, in which you go from auditory exclusion to intensified sounds. I had the privilege of talking to a law enforcement officer in Florida about his gunfight. He told me that he and his partner had conducted a traffic stop and had reason to arrest the driver and the passenger. They first handcuffed the passenger and put him in their police car. But when he placed the first cuff on the driver, the man suddenly grabbed a gun, spun, and fired a bullet into the second officer's brain, killing him instantly. The killer then spun and fired rounds into the first officer. The officer told me, "I saw that gun, and that's all there was in all the world. Tunnel vision. I didn't hear the shots. I heard nothing. Auditory exclusion. One of the rounds went through my vest and severed my spine. I tried to turn and run, but my legs weren't working. I couldn't understand why." When the officer fell to the ground, he could no longer see his assailant. His vision shut down so that he would have no visual memory of what followed, though he did hear the suspect's footsteps approaching, intensified sound. The footsteps stopped, then he heard bullets being fired into the back of his vest. Then the suspect fired one more bullet into the back of the officer's head. Fortunately, the angle was such that it did not penetrate his skull, although it did scalp him. The officer lay there bleeding and listening as the footsteps moved away. When I met this magnificent young warrior, he had built himself up to where He could walk with two canes and was dedicating his life to training others how to live with and overcome spinal injuries. Many people who have been in a gunfight talk about having significant gaps in their memory of the incident. When interviewed further, it turns out sometimes that they lost visual input during the gunfight, but they do have auditory memories of the event. In one case, a tactical team member was making entry into the front door of a house and ran straight into an ambush. The suspect had made a kind of foxhole by crouching down in the basement stairs, and as the officer rushed through the door, the man opened fire. I leaped to the right, off the well-lit porch, and over this wall, and hit the ground in total darkness. I used to think I had no memory of the event until I heard you teaching about this. Now, when I think back, I had sound, but once I got out of the light and out into the dark night, there wasn't anything for me to see. The officer's arm was horribly broken. He said, I was trying to get my arm up. I sort of flipped it up to try to hold my shotgun, but it wouldn't work. When I got back into the light, he was firing the shotgun one-handed. My eyes suddenly came back on, and I have memory of what happened after that. Sensory exclusion. I haven't got time for the pain. Pain is no evil unless it conquer us. Charles Kingsley, St. Maura. You have probably experienced sensory exclusion when you receive scrapes, scratches, and bruises in a wrestling match, fight, or a football game, and later you wondered how you got them. You were not aware of these injuries because during your stressful event, your sense of pain shut down. Other senses probably shut down too, but you were not aware of them since you did not bring home souvenirs such as your bruises and scrapes. My co-author experienced a classic example of this when he arrested a man on a warrant in the lobby of a precinct. The instant I grabbed the weight-trained ex-con, Christensen said, he started thrashing violently, slamming the two of us into walls, against the counter, and over the top of a long wooden bench. The suspect was oblivious to Christensen's wrist lock because the man's pumping adrenaline blocked his sense of pain. When Christensen finally managed to maneuver him into a position to really slam home an arm lock, the suspect yelped and leaped completely off the floor like a cat on a hot plate. Although this reaction is what Christensen wanted, the suspect unintentionally kneed him in the groin as he went airborne. I realized I'd been struck, Christensen said, but I didn't feel anything as I continued to wrestle him down onto the floor and subsequently into my handcuffs. I then half drugged and half walked him to a holding cell. It was not until Christensen locked the door and leaned against the table to catch his breath that a wave of nausea came calling. Nearly 10 minutes had passed since he had been struck, but it was not until his adrenaline began to subside that the pain and nausea hit. When the suspect's adrenaline subsided about 20 minutes later, he began shouting that his wrist was broken. Sensory overload. Tilt. Game over. Reboot. Stuns with thundering sound. Oliver Goldsmith, The Traveler. A flashbang is a device used by police tactical teams, such as SWAT, in situations where distraction, disorientation, or diversion is needed. According to the National Tactical Officers Association, the technically correct term for a flashbang is a noise flash diversionary device, or NFDD. When one is rolled into a room where a suspect is hiding, it explodes with a deafening bang and a blinding flash, causing a sensory overload so the officers can storm the room and overwhelm the stunned suspect. Artwall and Christensen give this example from a SWAT officer's personal experience. The suspect opened the small door and stepped out with the hostage in front of him. Although our sniper could only see a small portion of the suspect's forehead, a counter and a series of inter-office mail slots made the shot difficult. He fired, but a box deflected the round. Still, a bullet fragment struck the suspect, causing only a minor wound. The guy pulled the hostage back into the room, shouting for us to get back, and that he was going to kill her. This was it. We had to move. We ran along the wall until we got to the open door, and I threw the flashbang into the room. A second later, we rushed in and saw the guy standing in sort of an alcove where the employees hung their coats. The flashbang startled him because the woman was beside him now, and he was holding her with just one arm. We had our MP5s, submachine guns, on semi-auto. I fired into his face, and Miller fired into his chest. Blood and brain chips sprayed across the walls. The suspect crumpled to the floor. The flash stuns the suspect's eyes, and the bang stuns his ears. His skin feels the concussion, and his nose and mouth suck in some of the smoke. All five senses simultaneously send an emergency message to the brain, and the overloaded brain says, tilt, game over, reboot. The idea is to stun the suspect so that the officers can apprehend him without having to use deadly force. Problems arise, however, when a suspect is inadvertently inoculated to the flashbang. Occasionally, SWAT officers tell me that their flashbangs failed to work on a suspect. When I asked how many were used, they say something like, well, we used a dozen as we searched room to room before we finally found the suspect. While circumstances might have necessitated them to use flashbangs in every room, by the time they got to where the suspect was really hiding, he had been warned, emotionally prepared, and inoculated against the effect. We live in incredibly violent times. The domestic terrorism rate, international terrorism acts, and violent crime rates are at historical highs. When a police situation gets exceptionally violent, a tactical team is called in. If there is going to be a shooting, it is usually done by them, although in the vast majority of cases, they do not have to shoot. When they do, there is a tendency to blame the killing on the tactical team, though blaming them for having to use deadly force is like blaming a headache on the aspirin. The tactical team is the solution, not the problem. The National Tactical Officers Association has powerful data demonstrating that if not for these highly trained teams, the number of people killed in the line of duty would be vastly higher than it is. Remember Barney Fife and Andy Griffith in the old Andy Griffith Show? In a real situation where a Barney and Andy had to go in after a dangerous suspect, Barney would die, and Andy would have to kill the bad guy. In the real world, however, when a tactical team goes in with their shields, CS gas, flashbangs, negotiators, an overwhelming force, the majority of the time they do not have to kill the dangerous suspect, and the officers go home safely to their families at night. Flashbangs are a great tool that saves lives in these tragic, violent times. But most police officers and soldiers do not carry them on a daily basis. If you carry a weapon, however, you have a flashbang. You pull the trigger, it flashes, and it bangs. We know that a firearm is a psychologically daunting instrument. If you are a police officer, you must understand that in a large percentage of combat situations, the perpetrator is going to fire the first shot, meaning that you begin the engagement on the receiving end of a flashbang. Proper mindset and realistic training to develop autopilot responses can help warriors to overcome this problem. The bigger bang theory. Doink, doink versus bang, bang. Some certain of your brethren roared and ran from the noise of our own drums. Shakespeare, Coriolanus. Napoleon said that in war, the moral is to the physical as 3 is to 1. That is, the psychological factors are 3 times more important than the physical factors. In combat, one of the most important of these moral factors, or morale, or psychological factors, as we would call it today, is noise. In nature, whoever makes the biggest bark or the biggest roar is most likely to win the battle. Bagpipes, bugles, and rebel yells have been used throughout history to daunt an enemy with noise. Gunpowder was the ultimate roar, since it had both a bark and a bite. First used as fireworks by the ancient Chinese, and later in cannon and muskets, gunpowder was a noisemaker that provided sound and concussion. The concussion was felt and heard, and gunpowder provided the visual effects of flash and smoke. Since a gunpowder explosion and its drifting smoke could be tasted and smelled, it provided a powerful sensory stimulus that could potentially assault all five senses. This is one of the primary reasons why the early, clumsy, smoothbore muzzle-loading muskets replaced the longbow and the crossbow. The longbow and the crossbow had many times the rate of fire, more accuracy, and far greater accurate range when compared to the early smoothbore muskets. Yet these superior military weapons were replaced, almost overnight, historically speaking, by vastly inferior muskets. While they were inferior at killing, they were not inferior at psychologically stunning and daunting an opponent. Once when I asked a room of officers why incredibly superior killing instruments, like the crossbow and the longbow, were replaced with a comparatively useless musket, a police officer stood up and answered, "Administrators." That got a great laugh, but the truth is that very little happens on the battlefield without a good reason. In this case, if you are in battle, going doink, doink with a crossbow, and the other guy is going boom, boom with a musket, all things being equal, the doinker will lose every time. Some observers, not fully understanding the all-important psychological aspect of combat, have assumed that the longbow disappeared because of the lifetime of training required to master it. However, this logic does not apply nearly as well to the crossbow. If training and expense were the real issues, then the tremendous expense and lifetime of training needed to create a mounted knight or cavalry trooper and his mount would have been sufficient to doom those instruments of war. If a weapon system provides military dominance, be it the knight, the frigate, the aircraft carrier, the fighter jet, or the nuclear missile, then a society will devote the resources needed to get that weapon system. But if a more effective weapon is found, then the merciless Darwinian evolution of the battlefield will doom the older weapon and embrace the new. Thus, with the invention of the first crude muskets, the longbow and the crossbow were doomed. And the psychological reasons for this are, in Napoleon's words, three times more important than the physical. The concept of psychologically daunting and defeating your enemy is as old as Sun Tzu, writing 2,500 years ago. Clausewitz, in his classic 19th century book On War, said that shock and awe are necessary effects arising from an application of military power and are aimed at destroying the will of an adversary to resist. Of course, the shock and awe campaign used by the coalition forces and the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a large-scale application of this concept. But for our purposes here, we are applying it to small arms and close combat. You have probably heard of the Big Bang Theory. I call this the Bigger Bang Theory, which states that, all other things being equal, in combat, whoever makes the bigger bang wins. The psychological effects of gunpowder can be thought of as a continuum. At the top of the continuum are the flashbang, the hand grenade, the aerial bomb, and the artillery barrage. At the bottom is the pistol, and in between is the rifle. If you have been downrange and heard a rifle fire, you know that the concussion and the supersonic crack of a rifle bullet can be far more impressive than a pistol shot. Taking a rifle to a gunfight is the equivalent of taking a chainsaw to a knife fight. In both cases, you have a range advantage, a damage advantage, and a powerful psychological advantage. A classic example of this occurred in North Hollywood, California, on February 28, 1997, where two determined bank robbers, heavily armed and wearing body armor, fired hundreds of rounds from automatic weapons before police finally stopped them. When it was over, 17 people lay wounded, and the suspects were dead. What happened was that there were two idiots with assault rifles going boom, 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 boom. While LAPD officers, more than 200 were at the siege, shot back with 9mm pistols, going ding, 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 ding. All other things being equal, who wins this kind of gunfight? The answer is boom, boom, boom. That is the reality of combat. Now, it is not impossible for a man with a pistol to beat a man with a rifle. It happens all the time. It is just difficult. If you are a police officer and a suspect brings a rifle to a gunfight, it would be good if you had a rifle too. Rifles are slowly but surely replacing shotguns in the law enforcement community, and the time has probably come when every officer should be trained to use a rifle and carry it in his vehicle. Do you think the international terrorist threat is going to limit themselves to pistols? No. They will bring rifles and body armor to the gunfight. The terrorist rifle will punch right through our officers' body armor, while the cops' pistols will be physically and psychologically ineffective. Consider the 1999 massacre at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. Two kids, wearing long trench coats and armed with a variety of firearms, including a 10-shot, high-point model, 9.95 carbine rifle, and two Savage 12-gauge shotguns, came to school to bring death to their fellow classmates. When it was over, 14 students, including the killers, and one teacher lay dead, and 23 other students and faculty were seriously injured. The killers began their carnage in the front of the school, where a school resource officer pulled up and engaged them in a gunfight. He started out well. One report said he hit the magazine of one killer's carbine. However, he quickly ran out of ammunition and had to pull out, leaving the school to the two most horrendous juvenile mass murders we have ever seen. If he had had a rifle in his vehicle and had been trained to use it, do you think the situation in that school might have turned out differently? Sergeant Major Daniel Hendricks, a U.S. Army veteran with 2 years combat duty in Iraq and author of the book, A Soldier's Promise, wrote to me after I taught a class on the bulletproof mind at the U.S. Army Sergeant Major's Academy. He gives an excellent example of the bigger bang theory when the 120mm main gun of the Abrams tank was used in city fighting in Iraq. Remember, a 120mm gun is huge compared to anything used in the past. By comparison, the dreaded German Tiger tank, used late in World War II, carried an 88mm main gun. I wanted to thank you for shedding light on the science that is behind what I have already known to be true. The bigger bang theory holds a lot of merit for me. Being a first sergeant in the 3rd ACR, Armored Cav Regiment, during the invasion of Iraq in El Anbar, led me to understand the importance of that concept. Here is part of a report that I wrote following our first deployment. Use of the 120mm tank main gun in military operations in urban terrain, MOUT. No ambush or battle lasted longer than a couple of minutes when a 120mm main gun was fired. Of the 40 rounds fired, none were further than 500 meters, and some were as close as 25 meters. The effect of a HEAT, high-explosive anti-tank, 120mm main gun round, fired in MOUT, is devastating on the enemy's will to continue the fight. It is not devastating to the infrastructure of the city. Average engagement was 2 HEAT rounds. The most fired during enemy contact was 4 HEAT rounds. I was witness to Mouge, the enemy troops, continuing, very unsuccessfully, a fight against Bradley's 25mm main gun. Here is a weapon that is just as deadly as tanks, but the insurgents would continue to fight. I think the psychological effect of a 120mm tank main gun round, going off and echoing throughout the tight confines of a city, had an enormous effect on the enemy's will to fight. I can't remember one battle lasting over 5 minutes when we had the luxury of tanks. Even when I didn't have tanks, my Humvees, wheeled tactical vehicles, were loaded with at least 2 AT-4 anti-armor rockets, A similar effect was produced by the AT force. Sergeant Major Hendricks went on to say, I think the bigger bang theory is what defines my thoughts on escalation of force in my after-action report. Escalation of force. The hardest concept to get soldiers to understand was teaching them not to be at a disadvantage during an attack or ambush. If soldiers were being attacked with AK-47s, 7.62-millimeter rifles, and only returning fire with M4 or M16s, 5.6-millimeter rifles, then they are at a distinct disadvantage. The U.S. Army is touted as the most technologically advanced force and brings heavy firepower to the table. But on a daily basis, I would hear about and see our soldiers put themselves at a disadvantage. If attacked with RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, and only returning fire with machine guns, you are at a disadvantage. It takes a command decision to ensure your soldiers are given the best opportunity to survive and win every engagement. If you're attacked with small arms, priority is to maximize crew-served weapons. 7.62-millimeter M240B, 50-caliber M2s, 40-millimeter Mark 19s, immediately. If RPGs are fired, then return fire with 120-millimeter heat or appropriate weapon systems, AT-4 or 25-millimeter. An RPG, a high-explosive round, demands the most hostile response you can give. Most RPGs were fired from behind concrete walls or from within buildings. Firing only machine guns does not give you a high likelihood of immediately ending the engagement or defeating the ambush. Sergeant Major Hendricks concluded, after our year was up, we were replaced by a U.S. Marine Corps unit and got word of battles lasting up to 14 hours. We were confused by these reports until we realized they didn't have the luxury of tanks. Thanks again for the insight. In the end, winning the battle in the enemy's mind is the key to victory. And the bigger bang theory is a core concept that makes it possible to stun, daunt, and defeat your enemy. Whether you are a police officer using a rifle to defeat a felon armed with a pistol, or a soldier using a 120-millimeter tank round to defeat enemy troops on the modern battlefield. Tunnel vision. Like looking through a toilet paper tube. For now we see as through a glass darkly. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Dr. Artwall found that 8 out of 10 of the officers she surveyed experienced tunnel vision during their shootings. This is sometimes referred to as perceptual narrowing, and as the name implies, under extreme stress, such as occurs in a shooting, the area of visual focus narrows, as if the officer were viewing the situation through a tube. Christensen and Artwall tell of one police sergeant who says that as a suspect fired rounds at him from his handgun, his eyes focused totally on a ring the criminal wore on a finger of his gun hand. One law enforcement trainer and SWAT team member in South Florida tells how tunnel vision combined with auditory exclusion as he wrestled with the suspect armed with a sawed-off shotgun. Both of us had a hand on the muzzle, and both of us had a hand on the trigger of the shotgun. Most people talk about tunnel vision, saying that it is like looking through a toilet paper tube. For me, it was like a soda straw. This is one of many case studies indicating that, as your heart rate goes up, your tunnel vision can get narrower, and your auditory exclusion can increase. Then, he said, we're wrestling with a shotgun, and boom, the 12-gauge goes off between our faces. Can you think of anything much louder than a 12-gauge in your face? The thing that absolutely astounded me was that I didn't hear a sound, and afterward, my ears didn't ring. Here is an interesting example that gives us insight into how tunnel vision can affect shooting accuracy. A SWAT team in Portland, Oregon, streamed through the doors of a drug house, barking orders to two men sitting on a sofa and a third man sitting in a chair. The man in the chair leaped to his feet, pulled a small pistol from his pocket, and pointed it at the closest officer. The officer was faster, though, and fired a burst from his MP5 submachine gun, killing the man instantly. After all the rooms had been secured, and without further incident, the officers rolled the dead man over to retrieve his weapon. It was not there. As the officers searched every inch of the room, the SWAT officer who fired swore that the man held a pistol. Just as they were about to give up, a crime scene photographer noticed a paper bag under a table. An officer later said he had kicked it aside to get it out of the way during the commotion. Inside the bag were several nuts and bolts and the pistol. A subsequent investigation showed that the officer had seen the man pull the pistol from his pants and raise it quickly in his direction. At that moment, the pistol was all that mattered to the officer. It was all that he saw as he poured a stream of hot lead into the suspect's gun hand. The officer's concentrated fire ripped the weapon from the man's hand and launched it through the air before it landed neatly inside the open bag of bolts. Of course, the press tried to make a case that the gun had been planted in the bag, but there was one piece of evidence the media didn't know about until the police revealed it during the grand jury. Inside the trigger guard of the pistol was the man's severed trigger finger. Tunnel vision, along with auditory exclusion and a host of other perceptual distortions, are commonly associated with the high levels of anxiety normally present in everyone involved in a potentially lethal situation. In most cases, the same thing happens to your adversary. He may very well be looking at you through that toilet paper tube, or what others have called a hole in a donut. To take advantage of his visual distortion, sidestep quickly to your right or left so that you, in effect, disappear or go off his radar screen. In order to visually reacquire you, he has to blink, draw back, and move his head in your direction. In the critical second it takes for him to do that, you have a brief moment of advantage. This sidestep technique is now widely taught and has been found to be extremely valuable in paint bullet scenarios. Understanding the effect of tunnel vision helps us to design such techniques and to understand how they work. There is cause to believe that we can train warriors to break out of tunnel vision by having them scan and breathe after taking the shot. Physically turning the head and scanning the battlefield after an engagement seems to cause tunnel vision to diminish. Even if the warrior stays in tunnel vision, turning his head permits him to see additional threats, like scanning with a flashlight beam. Tactical breathing, which will be covered in detail later, also helps the individual to be calm and regain his composure. By having individuals scan and breathe on the range every time after every engagement, the procedure soon becomes a valuable and automatic conditioned response. There is enormous value in warning our warriors ahead of time that such phenomena might occur. One police officer, in Artwall and Christensen's book, gave a classic example of the tremendous advantages of knowing about these things. I've been involved in 3 shootings. Before the first 2, I had no training in what to expect. I performed well, but felt shocked, disoriented, confused, and at times out of control by all the weird stuff that I experienced during and after the shooting. I didn't know what to think, and that made it harder to cope during and after the event. After the second shooting, I sought counseling and learned about all that weird stuff I'd been experiencing. The doctor also taught me the principles of stress inoculation training, and I started using it to prepare myself for the future. Then, when I got into another situation, the training made all the difference in the world. This time, I knew what to expect, and I was even able to control and compensate somewhat for the tunnel vision, sound distortions, and other strange things my mind and emotions were going through. I also bounced back a lot quicker because I knew I wasn't crazy, and I knew what to do to take care of myself. Our goal is to create warriors like this, preferably before they go into combat for the first time. Forewarned is forearmed, and we must send our warriors into